Okay, thank you. So you have two, when you hear that the speaker's going to talk about random post packing, you have two responses. One, not you saying, not again, why is the member speaker talking about random post packing? The second thing you think is, I already know what random post packing is, why is the speaker going to talk about it? So I hope you don't feel that way, but I want to give a new twist, some different ideas to this old problem. And so some of the questions I want to ask are, what does random post packing mean? Is it the most dense random state, or is it the most likely random state? I tend to like this second definition more. It's the most likely random JF state. And from Torquato and coworkers, an idea that's been pushed recently is that the terms random and close pack are at odds, and that the algorithm you can basically get any answer for this for random close packing because different algorithms will give you different answers.
And what do you mean by jam?
Yeah. And so, and I was just about to say, a lot of these words are sort of vocabulary that I need to define, and I'll get to those. You know, for instance, random I need to define jammed and close packing. So I'll try to define those. One word I will stay away from is the word random, because I don't know what the song is in jam states, and random, I won't need to define that word. So again, the issue that I want to get at is if there's a way to define random close packing without that's relatively insensitive to the protocol that I use to create those jam states. So my plan of attack for answering these questions is a brute force attack, a computational brute force attack. That I'm going to study small systems, and I want to just enumerate all the collectively jammed states, and again, that's a terminology that I need to define. I'll define that in a slide or two. I just want to enumerate all the possible ways of getting the jammed states. And the different idea in this talk is that you can define random close packing through the ensemble of these jammed states. That as you look at this ensemble, as you go to larger and larger systems, then random close packing will sort of appear in that ensemble. Another new idea, PFI is an important quantity in this talk. PFI is the probability that you get a jam state at a particular volume fraction, a packing fraction phi. And a new element coming out of this work is that probability distribution can be decomposed into two functions. A density of jam packing fractions, which is distinct from the frequency distribution. So you can decompose that probability distribution into those two composite functions. Again, I want to stay away for the purpose of this talk. I want to study, I'm studying two-dimensional systems. It's a little easier than three-dimensional. And I want to frustrate the system by studying two different size particles. And these particle diameters differ by a factor of 1.4. So why study random close packing? I've already alluded to that it's an old problem. It's a simple question. What's the most likely jam state that you get? But it has a very complicated answer. And Torquato and coworkers have discussed this in great detail. There are, it's not just that I want to, harp on this point of random close packing. I think there's a sort of a general class of problems that I want to talk about. It's better understanding the relationship between configuration space and slow dynamics. That if you really understood the the phase space in better detail, you could better predict when systems will slow down. And I have a few examples of problems that occur, or interesting things that happen in jam systems that are basically due to the geometry of configuration space. So these three things that I'm highlighting here, interesting effects, that different jam states can have the same volume fraction, but then possess very different mechanical properties. That's an interesting problem. That a state that's originally unjammed can jam just by applying a shear stress. And the final thing is that nearly jam states at the same density can take very long, different time scales to unjam. And these three sort of interesting topics are related, or just because its configuration space is so complicated. So, just going to have to let's stop that. So some, let's define some terminology. And maybe in hindsight, I shouldn't have done this, but I'm trying to, there's a community that studies hard-sphere packings. And I do want to study hard-sphere packings, but you'll see in a moment that in order to create hard-sphere packings, I actually relax that constraint and use soft-sphere potentials to create hard-sphere packings. But in that community, they use these terms, locally jammed, collectively jammed, and strictly jammed. And so let me talk about those. A locally jammed state is basically a state that is each particle has, in two dimensions, three contacts. So if you hold all the surrounding particles fixed, that single particle can't move. But that state's not rigid. It doesn't have enough contacts. So here I've created a locally jammed state. And if I add some dynamics, the dynamics will find the easy way out. And I'm jammed. And I think it just did that. I added some dynamics. Had an initial state that was locally jammed, but it wasn't rigid. I added some dynamics, and it found its way in. Collectively jammed states are states that are rigid with respect to displacements of all the particles. So in this case, I have frictionless particles. So if these have four contacts, then this is rigid. And each particle has four contacts, roughly, then this state is rigid. And so if I put on dynamics, the same type of dynamics, this one should just bounce around and stay in this order. So there's a third category, which is strictly jammed, which is rigid.
Well, what's the sense of our collective motions?
So that's actually a different question. So what I'm really addressing here are what are the modes which cost zero energy. And so these have a lot, and then these have none. And then a separate question is, well, what are the modes that cost finite energy?
So you can have either of these without the other, as you stated, right? Because the first condition is actually very strong, that like each particle has three contacts. I mean, if you just take this picture down below and put one particle in that hole in the middle,
right, so
then it wouldn't satisfy it first.
Right. So I'm trying to pull a fast one. I mean, I don't want to allow these floater particles. So what I'm going to do is I want to just look at the framework essentially and not include the
floater. But I shouldn't think of one of these as a subset of the other. That's what I'm saying.
I don't think so.
Yeah, because it sounds to me like
they're good. So, are these totally rigid particles, or do they have an elasticity themselves?
These actually are totally rigid, but that's not. These actually are totally rigid.
Okay, but you're not putting that into this definition.
Let me come back to that when I talk about how I'm creating it. So, really, I'm just putting these up just to, maybe it's not a good thing to do, but just to say that if you have in two dimensions, three contacts, you'll have some modes which cost zero energy.
What energy are you measuring?
I'll get to that in 1 second.
You get stuck with these asking if you have a mixed state where you have clusters that are collectively jammed, but then there are others that can move just in the manner of a top one.
So what I find is that what you get are, there'll be a rigid backbone, there'll be a backbone, and then there can be some holes that have floater particles.
No, but not even that, you could have them from the kind you have on the top.
I don't get those.
A mixed thing between
I do not get a mix between the second and the first. I either get the collectively jammed or the locally. I think I'll answer those questions in two slides, but ask it again if I don't. So the work that I'm doing is motivated by this result. This result is the, and I have to again define very carefully what I mean by jam state, and I will in one slide, but just let me put up this result. This is a probability that you get a jam state at a particular volume fraction phi. So to calculate it, you you carry out a bunch of trials with your protocol that's used to generate jam states. You count the number of trials that jam in a particular volume fraction finding, then divide by the total number of trials. So that's simply what I'm plotting here versus the volume fraction. And what you see is I do it for different system sizes, small system sizes, say 18 particles have a fairly wide distribution, and then this distribution narrows as you increase the system size. So what's happening is the distribution is narrowing, this is the liquid of distribution, and this is the location of the distribution. So as the system size gets very large, this function becomes a delta function at some magic value, which depends on the particular system you're studying. And this this feature led us to believe that this is a nice way to define random close packing, that you look at the ensemble of jam states, collectively jam states, and you look at the limit of that distribution, you can see the system size limit. Now, that begs the question, why is this distribution doing this? Why is it narrowing? Why is it going to a particular value of volume fraction, the system size limit? So, just two possibilities that can happen are that there are few collective jam states with volume fractions that are different from this peak value. Just geometrically, there aren't any that exist. That's one possibility. The second possibility is that they do exist over a wide range of phi, over the whole range, but they're just not very likely. And so we want to explore those two questions. And the idea is that if this limiting distribution and the infinite system size limit doesn't depend very sensitively on the protocol, then this is a good definition of random close packing.
Corey? Yeah, just on the question of distance. Can you say something based on certain crystalline packings, kind of the honeycomb and then the hexagonal lattices being kind of two? I guess that would be modern dispersed, but.
You mean what are the limits of, you mean how high can this go and then, a limiting density, at least for mono dispersed, would be 0.907. And then leverage. But again, the real issue is in the title of the talk, counting ways. And so what's really going to dominate are the ones that are most that what you'll see. And what I'm really interested in are the most numerous ones. So the newish idea in this talk is this decomposition. So I want to decompose this probability distribution into two composite functions. And I want to do it in a particular way. I want to do it in a way that one function is independent of the dynamics. So one function, rho, the density of jammed packing fractions, is independent of dynamics, and then put all the dynamics into this other function, beta phi, which is the frequency distribution. It's how often you get a particular distinct jam state and volume fraction phi. So again, one is protocol or dynamics independent, the other is dynamics dependent. And you can do this decomposition if you really can convince yourself that you have all the states. And the idea I want to get at is that if rho of phi, if this purely geometric factor controls the shape of the total distribution in the large system limit, then defining random close packing as the limit of this distribution is a well-defined thing. If on the other hand the dynamics controls, determines the distribution, then the dynamics is going to control this the width and the location of this distribution. So more about some nitty-gritty details about how I actually create these jam states and how I classify what I mean by jammed and how I classify. So a bunch of what I'm going to do first is tell you a few words, and then in the next slide I'll show you a movie, and that'll probably make it more clear. So this is my protocol. I start with a random collection of disks that are two sizes, so ignore that feature of this figure. This figure has all the same size. But I start with an initial volume fraction that's very low, and the first thing I do is minimize the total potential energy in the system. So this speaks, I think, to Jim's question or some other questions. But I'm actually, creating hard-sphere states using a soft-sphere potential. So the particles interact pairwise through this linear repulsive spring potential. So there's a a repulsive force that kicks in when the particles overlap, and then there's no interaction when they don't overlap. And the total potential energy is the sum of those pair interactions. So, with that type of interaction, there are two possibilities. There are two minimum energy configurations. There's one where they don't, there's one that's zero, where they don't overlap. And then there's another one where there's force balance in every particle with non-zero potential energy. So these are the only two possibilities, and I sort of use that fact in creating these GM states. What I really want to do is study systems with force balance and finite potential energy, total potential energy, and just bring that total potential energy down to zero, or as close to zero as I can. So I approach the jam state from a, sort of from above, bringing this value of the potential energy down to zero. So let me show a movie. So there I started off with a low volume fraction, and the particles are growing. After each growth step, I take a finite growth step, I minimize the total potential energy, I take another finite growth step, and you see the first steps are easy because the particles will sort of just interact pairwise and they just move away from each other. But then you see as they have, as the network comes into contact, it becomes harder, it takes more time to minimize the energy because you have to get force balancing on the particle.
And how do you do that? You put in some noise or?
No. So they, so just the locations of the particles put in the noise. So where's the chalk? Maybe I should just show it again. So I just threw things down randomly, and some of them will overlap each other. So the first minimization step is easy at low density because the particles will just move to the right of contact. And then I grow the particles by a finite amount of change in volume fraction, and that'll cause an overlap. And so I minimize the energy again. I'll grow, minimize the energy again. Since I don't know exactly where the volume fraction is at which they just come into contact, and it's a mechanically stable state, I'll overrun that. In other words, I'll increase the volume fraction too much. So I know that happens when I get a value of the total potential energy, which is non-zero. And so then I have to decrease the volume fraction. So I toggle back and forth, increasing and decreasing the volume fraction until I get a state which is just like this. Which has the properties which I'll talk in the next slide. So what I do is I do this increasing and decreasing the volume fraction and relaxation billions of times for a range of system sizes. And I look at the distributions. The states, the final states that I create have these properties. So they're rigid in the sense that when you look at the rigidity matrix, which is just the matrix of second derivatives of the total potential energy, it has dn, where d is 2n minus d, where these are, I have to subtract these off because of the translation invariance. All those eigenvalues are positive. So what I was saying before about local jam states, that there would be some eigenvalues which were zero. And so there would be some allowed motions, the nearest space of free motions. So these are mechanically stable states, and so you can also ask, well, are they isostatic? So most of the states I find are isostatic in the sense that they have the minimal number of contacts required, but actually I do find some which have more than the minimal number of contacts. But for this 2D guidance per system, that's a small fraction of the number of states.
Do you guys get rattlers?
Yes, I do get rattlers, and I do get rattlers.
Sorry, the protocol, the randomness is in the initial distribution of particles, right?
Right.
And we are sure that the swelling does not change, does not induce order in the system.
Well, in one sense, I don't really care. I mean, I want to use a protocol and then just generate everything. So, I mean, I'm not saying that the final state is a random state. I will get random states. I may also get some which have some order. In fact, your question is a very good one when you talk about, you know, what if I switch to monitor systems?
Yes.
Then maybe your crushing algorithm will get some order. But I'm hoping that this algorithm...
Or to some Monte Carlo algorithm.
The same question. What I'm thinking of is you have some very complex topology on this potential energy surface, and you're trying to locate all the zeros. Hopefully, they're all zeros. And same kind of question. This is the kind of thing that you would do with a genetic algorithm, for example. It seems that instead, what you do, each random selection that you start with moves continuously to one potential energy minimum. And then the randomness is hoping that you sample another potential energy. Is that the picture for and so...
So that you throw a dart and you land somewhere in the landscape, and then you go to the nearest nodes. I'm hoping that my dart throw... So there may be a better way.
No, I'm just wondering whether there are bizarre configurations that you don't start with. Whether the sampling is...
Yeah, so I'm doing uniform sampling on configuration space, and going to the nearest
city. Okay,
initial state, you ever start with the particles up in the corner?
So we did start from above. We did start from very over-compressed states and then try to go down. But those you tend to get funneled into some sort of very deep minima, and then they just take you down. So definitely starting from above is not the way to go.
But how do you generate the initial state? You just throw the points down.
I just throw the points down.
And then let them grow as small disks or large disks.
But this could be sampling the higher density states in a very biased way.
You mean the ones from...
You might get a, for instance, well, obviously if you change the protocol, which I think you want to do anyway, to see the robustness of this feature, perhaps, maybe that's the point. But that protocol, in principle, should result in very different sampling of high density states.
High density meaning the ones...
Yeah, let's say just before jamming. So let's say, rather than starting with 40%...
So one thing we have done is to make to change the initial density.
Okay, right. And, I was going to say, to start with that.
So we have started, we've done an array of initial densities, so we find that sort of the best way is to start with as low as possible.
That's in what sense?
That you get the most states with the least number of tries.
Okay, but do you sample the final jam states in very different ways?
Yes. So, but that's
okay.
That's a good question. But I'm not as interested in that yet. I mean, it's a great question. You're basically saying, well, what's your protocol mechanics? But let me just study this one protocol and just see what I do. So since I do want to break the distribution up, this probability distribution up into, you know, geometric factors and frequency distribution, how much time do I have? So I'm sort of halfway through. Can I take 10 more minutes? So I want to break it up into a frequency distribution and a geometric factor. And so in order to do that, I need to take, you know, you take two trials and you get two answers at the end. You need to know whether those are the same or different. So the way I do that is I look at the eigenvalues in this rigidity matrix, and I just go eigenvalue by eigenvalue, and I see if they're all the same, if they're all different. I've also looked at topologies. What I mean by topologies is that the list of neighbors of each particle, and compare them state by state to see whether they're different. So, In a nutshell, what I'm saying is that when you do two trials and you get two final answers, I have a way of telling whether those two final states are the same. And because I'm performing so many trials, you actually do get the same state twice, or many, many different times. So one thing that I get asked a lot, which is a great question, is how do you know you have all the states? And so I can't prove that I have all the states, but I can do some numerical checks to show that I have nearly all the states for this algorithm. And so what I'm showing here is the number of states divided by my estimated total that I need to get. It's the number of states at a certain value of the number of trials. And this is divided by the estimated total number of states and the total number of trials, estimated number of trials that I need to get that total number of states. So you can see some good things from this plot. One is that that's very interesting is that there appears to be a master curve. So if you study systems that are larger than roughly 8 particles, these curves tend to collapse. And that makes estimating the numbers NS-tope and NT-tope easier to estimate. Another thing which we've done is, you know, we estimate the number of trials that we need to get all the states, and then we do 10 and oftentimes 100 times those trials to make sure that indeed we don't get any new states according to this protocol. And the final good thing, which is really good, is that we completely changed our protocol, the dynamics, and made sure that we got the same set of states. Not the same frequency distribution, but the same distinct states. And the protocol we used was, again, a swelling and shrinkage algorithm, but we used molecular dynamics with dissipative forces and dynamic friction forces. And we get different distributions, which is very interesting, and you know, in my next talk will be on how those distributions change. But we get the same set of states for these small system settings. This is a very hard calculation, and I'd be interested in hearing any thoughts on maybe improving algorithms. This shows, which you all know this already, that the number of states grows exponentially, the system size and the number of trials that you need grows exponentially in system size to get all those states. So now I'm going to show you the distributions. This is this geometric factor. It's how the distinct states are distributed in body fraction space. So it's the number of states within a range 5 plus d5 and 5. Normalized by the total number of states. And so the thing you're supposed to get from this, number one, is that it's a hard calculation that here I show this distribution as a function of the fraction of total states, and it shifts. So this function is hard to get, and it shifts the way you would expect. The lower density states are very rare, and so as you capture more of the states, this distribution is shifted to lower line fractions. Another thing you're supposed to get to this is that this looks fairly Gaussian, looks somewhat Gaussian, and so you're supposed to remember that over the next two slides. Because the total distribution is a multiplication of this rho of phi and beta of phi, you're supposed to notice that the rho of phi sort of expanded to the left, and therefore, I'll show you in another slide that p of phi is not dependent on the total number of trials, and therefore this beta of phi, this frequency distribution, actually has to go the other direction towards higher phi. So this is the frequency distribution. It's how many times do you get a GM state at a particular volume fraction of phi. And so the thing you're supposed to get from this is that it's monotonic, that the most frequent states are those states with the highest volume fraction, and then that falls off as an exponential, just to remember that, as you go to lower volume fractions. So the first one you're supposed to think that its shape was roughly Gaussian, this one is exponential. And another very interesting thing is that the total distribution is very insensitive to the number of trials. So in contrast to the composite functions that make up this total distribution, the total distribution is not dependent on the total number of trials. So you see that here, that the symbols, like these squares and the solid line, have very different numbers of trials. One is, say, 10,000 trials, the other, you know, millions and millions of trials, and the points don't shift. So basically, this distribution is captured by the most frequent states. Using that fact, you can start to make some important statements about the distribution and their composite functions. So the first thing here I show, so now I can calculate the total distribution as a function of system size, and I don't really have to worry that much that I'm getting all the states because the most frequent states are determining this distribution. So here I show this total distribution as a function of system size. I already showed it before, which what you're supposed to see here is that it's a Gaussian, the excel line is a fit to a Gaussian, it's becoming more Gaussian as you go into larger system sizes. Okay, and then here's the punchline. Again, I stressed at the beginning that the total distribution was made up of these two composite functions. I measured these two composite functions in this these small bytes per systems, and this is what I found. So here I emphasized that the total distribution was Gaussian, and here I showed evidence that the frequency distribution was exponential. And therefore you know that the this large system limit, this geometric factor, this rho, has to be also Gaussian. And so some of the things that you know is that the this geometric quantity, the distribution of Jan line fractions, has the same width as the total distribution. So the width of the total distribution is determined by this geometric factor. And the location of the peak, which I want to assign a grand post packing, is the location of the geometric peak plus a shift. And the shift depends on the width of the distribution and the exponent of this exponential. And so what we really have to do is try to estimate, which we've only done a little of, estimate how these two factors compare in the system size limit. And so if this sigma squared lambda goes to zero at larger and larger system sizes, then the random close packing is defining random close packing as the peak position in the total distribution is a well-defined way of
So you're saying that your protocol, as things get larger, tends to go to the most typical states, to the ones that are more abundant, because there is no effect of the lambda.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is that if this turns out to be true, that this scales away in large system sizes, then what's determining the location of the peak in that distribution are the
abundance.
The abundance that there are just a lot of states at that value. That didn't have to be true.
No, but it's saying that the protocol is not very good, right? Because you know you can go deeper with some other methods. So it's just saying that you get trapped in
the but it could be saying that, I mean, what if I did this with a Monte Cristo system? I mean, I am going to generate, you know, those higher pack states. And so I asked a similar question with that. So I think what it's saying is that for this class of algorithms, then defining random close packing with this, according to the peak in this distribution is one more. So I just want to say two, then I'll let David have the stage, two future directions. One, I think this is an interesting result. So I don't, two future directions are monodisperse systems, which I just alluded to, and friction systems. So monodisperse systems, I again want, there's been lots of debate about whether random close packing can be defined for monodisperse disks. And so I just want to add some preliminary results in that line. One, that, so here I'm showing the same functions. The total distribution, which is the solid line, so it has two peaks, which is already interesting. The geometric factor has just one peak, which is interesting. And then the frequency distribution is biased heavily towards the large line fraction peak. So the things I want to say here that are interesting are, what happens to the total distribution of our system limit? Does the second peak stay around, which would be a sort of a way to define random close packing, or does everything just go towards the crystallized states, which are representative of the large fine peak? The other thing is maybe a way of defining random loose packing. Maybe random loose packing is the limit of this distribution if I include friction in my protocol. So the preliminary results that I have in that line are that for a fixed system size, I study the distribution with and without friction. So this is large friction. It's a large friction limit. And the preliminary result that I have is that the distribution is wider and shifted to the left. And so both these monodisperse systems and frictional systems, I need to do more work. But I think those two results are pretty interesting. Thank you.
Attention of the collected animals.
No, so this is the static version. So I have shown that with the dynamic friction, that I get the same set of states, but the dynamics is affected, so that the beta function was changed. But static friction, you get a different set of states.
In your monodisperse case, when your P has two peaks,
yeah.
What are we supposed to, what intuition should we use to understand what the different states are? Why is it seeming to choose these two different,
So first let me just say what's going on. So the total distribution is the product of two functions, the rho and the beta. And so that's why there's a small peak here, that this rho has a huge peak, but then it's multiplied by a very small number, and so you get a modified peak. But the thing that, to address your question, or if you take the infinite system size limit, I think this becomes the crystalline states at very close to 0.907, the triangular lattice. And the question is there a sort of a residual set, a large set of states, which are amorphous, which would exist around quoted numbers or around 82%. And so I want to know whether in the infinite system size limit there's an abundance of states at 0.82.
Can you just explain once again, how do you define states? Is it just topology, or you keep relative distances between particles constant?
So I get something out of my protocol. I carry out a trial, which is putting particles down randomly and growing and swallowing, and then that stops. And that stops at a very small total potential energy, which is above my noise threshold. That's sort of the best I can do. So at one level, my final state is a state with a local potential energy minimum that's above zero, slightly above zero. Then what I do are some diagnostics. What I do is I calculate the rigidity matrix. And I ask, does that have all non-zero positive eigenvalues?
The same
eigenvalues. So there's state one, and it has an energy that's around zero, but greater than zero. And here's state two, which has an energy which is slightly above zero. And then I need to, then I look at the eigenvalue spectrum. And I make sure that they're all positive, or all the right ones are positive. Those are two valid states. Then I have to do one more thing. I have to know whether they're the same or different. And so what I do is I look at the eigenvalue spectrum and see if they're the same or different. The other thing that I have done is I looked at the topology and verified that, you know, if eigenvalue spectrum are different, or, you know, then these all have different topologies also. And what I mean by topology is the list of instruments.
In the cutting-off limit, both of these spectra are going to become cutting-off.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a good one. You're saying that as you take the continuum limit, then the differences are going to be very small.
How distinct are the differences anyway?
I mean, in these eigenvalue spectrum? So for the system sizes I've been looking at, they're much above the noise.
No, but I mean, is it when you're saying that two states are the same, is it really clear that you've got exactly the same eigenvalue?
Right, it is. It's very clear. It's very above the noise. Very much above the noise. You have a great point, but that hasn't come into play yet, because so far, at least in the protocols I've been using, you know, I'm far from the continuum limit, and I'm still actually making, I think, an
improvement. The number of contacts, can you, given that you have all the states, you know how they evolve the packing fraction, how do they depend? Is it the highest, most typical are more isostatic, and as you go down, the rare ones that have...
Right, so, good question. So, right now I've been studying this bidisperse system, which actually has the property that most of the states I get are actually isostatic. Even the ones that
have...
Even the ones that have... If that is going to be violated, it's going to be the ones that are...
But you don't see any significant. They're mostly...
For this particular, for the bidisperse case that I looked at, they're most, I know that it's 99% or higher for isostatic. If I study monodisperse case, then it totally changes and then I get more. Lots and lots of error. 99%. But that's an interesting question. The 2D monodisperse system, I think that one peak, the one peak on the left and the lower density corresponds to the isostatic space, and maybe the higher peak corresponds to the upper space.
Okay, any further questions? Ms. Kankowski?